is a principle of physics that decreed that the more accurate the determination of a particle's direction, the less accurate the determination of its momentum, and vice versa. That the very process of observing, of sending photons to ricochet off the particle in the first place, inevitably, changed either the direction or the momentum, making it impossible to ascertain both to the same degree of accuracy. He was the photon, he realized. Titan's fate could change, because he was observing it, which meant that he could do something to change it. He would do more than identify the problem. He would solve it. And when he brought a solution to Alars, then, finally, his father would listen. He summoned a brace of androids from the storage room.
"Clean this up," he told them, "and install a new interface desk."
They beeped and chirped happily as they set about their tasks. Thanos watched them work. Unless he succeeded, when the end came, they would be all that would survive. Chapter 7. A day later, he found himself in a corridor outside Gwynth Falar's residence. She shared quarters with her family, two parents, four siblings, two married relations, a niece, and two nephews. The corridor was crowded with commuters leaving their own domiciles for the day. Thanos was an unwelcome intrusion into their routine. Snarls and complaints thickened the air in his wake.
"I apologize for abandoning you the other night," he told Gwynth when she calmed him from the security camera. "You inspired me to do something I had been putting off for many years."
He paused, considering for a moment not telling her what he'd done, but then discarded the idea. She needed to know.
"I saw my mother for the first time since my birth. You gave me the courage to do that. You inspired it."
The door slid up an instant later, as though she'd been waiting just beyond it for exactly those words. Her expression mingled shock and sorrow, and something else that it took him a moment to identify, so unfamiliar was it to him. Compassion.
"You saw your mother?"
Like everyone on Titan, she knew that Sui-san had been locked away.
"After a fashion,"
he conceded, stretching out his hand to her.
"I meant to come back to you right away, but something intervened. Something enormous. Will you walk with me?"
Her hesitation did not offend him. It was only sensible, and in any event, it wasn't long. She took his hand.
"Of course."
He led her to the outskirts of the Eternal City, close to the edge of the safe terraform zone. The foothills of the cryo-volcanoes were smooth and peaceful. Deep beneath, cryo-magma burbled and crackled with cold.
"We're all going to die?"
she said when he finished explaining his epiphany to her.
"All that lives dies," he told her. "The catastrophe my model predicts relies on a broad array of variables, but it will occur. It could be next month, or it could be as long as 10 generations from now."
10 generations?
Gwynth murmured.
"By which point you and I will have been long dead anyway. But yes, everything we see here,"
he gestured to the sweeping skyline of the Eternal City,
"will be gone, and everyone within no more than dust. Unless we act."
Her eyes searched his features as though they held the answer.
"You can save us?"
she asked at last.
"I believe I can. The question is, should I? The cataclysm is enormous. The price to be paid to stop it cannot be small."
"We're talking about the survival of our entire species, our way of life,"
Gwynth told him.
"You have to do it. You have to do whatever it takes, Thanos. Save Titan."
He paused, then bent to her and kissed her. The connection was still there. It wasn't a fluke or a side effect of his first kiss. It was real, and it was pounding in his heart like blood. Yes. Yes, this was worth the price, any price, to save.
Thanos approached his father not with fear or dread, but rather with certainty. Certainty that Alars would reject him once again. He knew that his father had no love for him and little respect, yet some intractable filial impulse compelled him to give his father one more chance to be a part of the solution that Thanos knew could save the world.
"Father, I would like to speak with you," he said,
standing at the door to Alar's cogitarium.
"It is a matter of some urgency."
After several seconds, the response came through the comm mounted next to the door.
"Is the world about to end?"
Alars said with some asperity. Thanos chose to treat the question as genuine, not rhetorically sardonic.
"Eventually, yes. Not in the near term, I believe."
There was no rejoinder, no scoffing, no scorn. Alars simply said nothing more. Thanos waited at the door for close to an hour, but his father did not speak, nor did he emerge. And so Thanos took matters into his own hands. Holograms were simple manipulations of photons, and sound was merely the vibration of air molecules. Transmitting a fully audible hologram had been perfected long ago. It was science so simple that few people even thought of it as science any longer. It was just part of life. Thanos needed something a little more robust than the typical hologram, though. He needed to broadcast to every person who lived on Titan, in a way that could not be ignored. If Alars would not take him seriously, then he would put his ideas into the hands of the entire population. Let them take action while his father sat safely ensconced behind the doors of his study, planning the next mentor plex that would only stave off the catastrophe he didn't even believe in, and doing nothing to stop it. Thanos developed a hologram of himself that was 100 meters tall, with a series of photonic refractor particles that would make the hologram appear to be facing whoever was looking at it. His appeal would be personally directed to every individual in the Eternal City. He considered using a different image, perhaps even that of his father. But that would be a fraud. He was about to communicate a great and horrible truth to his people. He could not open with a lie. He had data that indicated precisely when the greatest number of people were outdoors. He generated the hologram at that time, projecting it via a series of gliding androids such that it loomed over the city. At first it did nothing, merely stood in midair. It didn't take long for people to notice, for sky cars to drift through it and pause, causing worse traffic congestion than was usual in the skyways. From buildings and from the street, from vehicles and from rooftops, the people of the Eternal City looked up, and when Thanos was certain he had the attention of as many Titans as possible, he allowed his hologram to speak its message.
"I am Thanos, son of Alars and Suisan. My people, my fellow Titans, I greet you with great love and with greater fear. Our world is imperiled, and we must act boldly to save it. We are, by every measure that matters, a great people. We have conquered the wilderness of Titan and bent it to our will. We have raised mighty structures, tamed the cryovolcanoes, built monuments of art and science and achievement. And it will all be for naught, for we are doomed."
He proceeded to recite a series of statistics about arable land, recyclable water volumes, death rates, and birth rates. He spoke briefly about pathogens and disease. With a collection of holographic charts and graphs, he explicated the rapid diminution of the metal ore that would be needed to continue to construct enough mentor plexes to house the burgeoning population.
"Mentor plexes 2 and 3,
he pointed out,
"will be at capacity on the day they open. And still, an estimated 600,000 Titans will live in constrained quarters. We literally cannot build fast enough to house everyone, and even if we could, we would run out of necessary materials and food before we finished. Everything we do to stave off the threat only contributes to the weakening of our environment and increases the chances that the variables will line up sooner rather than later. We are shoveling dirt out of a hole, not aware that every shovelful rains back down on us and threatens to bury us. We live in a graveyard. We just haven't interred ourselves yet. I don't want this to be true. I don't want any of it to be true. But I am a slave to fact and truth and science. The conclusion is inescapable, my friends. We face darkness and apocalyptic disaster if we do nothing. However, there is a way out. My proposition is simple, so I will be brief. I submit that in order to stave off this inevitable catastrophe, we voluntarily euthanize roughly 50% of our current population. This population reset will ensure that our species has the time and motivation to adjust our way of life. It is too late to prevent this catastrophe without drastic measures, but it will not be too late to prevent the next one. In the interests of objective fairness, I have developed a perfectly random selection algorithm that will choose our proud martyrs without bias as to class, age, deportment, or creed. Furthermore, in a show of absolute faith in the rightness of my conclusions, I have hard-coded a single titan into the algorithm, one who will be auto-selected to be put to death. That person is, of course, me. I am happy to die for the greater good, for the sanctity and salvation of our future generations. If nothing else does, let this be proof of my urgency and sincerity. I have devised an exceedingly humane method of painless euthanasia, he went on. No one needs suffer. We are not monsters. According to my math, this solution will guarantee a safe and prosperous Titan for 1,000 more generations. Consider the lives that will come into being, secure in the knowledge that the sacrifice of their ancestors, us, has guaranteed them safety, stability, and well-being into the foreseeable future.
The hologram paused here, long enough for the message to sink in.
A small price to pay,
Thanos said to his world.
A small, sensible price to pay to warrant our future.
Chapter 8. Oddly, Gwynth did not respond when he tried to call her. According to her personal beacon, she was online and available, but she did not answer his hail. She was the first person he thought to contact after his message was delivered. It was technically still being delivered. He'd set the hologram to repeat itself every half hour for 4 hours, just to be sure the message sank in. Sitting in his room, controlling the broadcast from his interface desk, Thanos had no idea of the reception to his announcement in the Eternal City. When he called Cinta, his friend only said, anguished,
"What have you done? What have you done?"
And then signed off, leaving Thanos with the echo of Cinta's terror and the afterimage of the haunted expression on his face. Thanos emerged from the Mentorplex into a quieter world than he'd ever known. The usually crowded streets were now empty of passers-by. Had everyone retreated to their houses to discuss his plan? That would make sense. Overhead, his hologram recited its dirge. He was pleased and slightly unnerved to find that his photon refraction technique had worked. The hologram seemed to be addressing him directly. His own visage, several stories tall, stared at him. So strange. He proceeded to Gwynth's home. He rang and rang, and eventually she opened the door. Tears streamed down her face, blurring the pristine, painstakingly placed green dotted pattern makeup she wore.
"How could you?"
she whispered before he could say anything.
"How could I?"
he asked.
"What do you mean?"
Her eyes widened.
"Thanos! Thanos, have you lost your mind?"
He gave the matter a moment's consideration.
"Not at all. I'm fine."
He took her hands in his. They were limp and lifeless.
"Is something wrong?"
Jerking her hands out of his grasp, she took a step back,
Is something wrong? Is something wrong? You have lost your mind. How could you do that?
She flung a hand out behind her, where he could see, through a window in the apartment, his hologram.
I...
He paused, licked his lips, thought carefully.
I'm doing exactly what you told me to do, Gwynth.
With a glare, she raked her fingers through her close-cropped hair.
What I told you to do?
We're talking about the survival of our entire species,
he quoted her.
Our way of life. You have to do it. You have to do whatever it takes, Thanos. Save Titan.
Horrified, she took another step back.
Not this. Not this.
Whatever it takes,
he told her.
It's the only way. Don't you think I considered all possibilities? Don't you think I would have exhausted every possible methodology before suggesting something so radical? We can't leave the planet. The effort required to construct the necessary fleet would exhaust resources even more quickly and just hasten the—
Listen to you, she shouted. This is all just science to you, but it's people's lives.
He blinked rapidly. Hadn't she been listening to him?
Yes. Lives I'm going to save. Well, half of them.
She covered her mouth with her hands, tears flowing afresh, and stepped fully inside, letting the door slide shut between them. No matter how much he thumbed the entry button, and even when he mimicked Cinta and banged at the door with his fists, she did not answer. He tried Cinta next.
You have to take it back,
his best friend said in a slow, careful tone.
You have to recant. Immediately.
They sat in the antechamber of Cinta's house, the small receiving room just adjacent to the living quarters. Out of deference to Cinta's family, they kept their voices low, though even the soft volume of his friend's voice could not belie the urgency of his words.
Recant. I said nothing false. Everything I said is empirically true.
Cinta groaned and leaned back, hands on knees.
Thanos, no one cares about your empirical truth. Have you seen the reports? After your broadcast, there were riots in the Eternal City. Panic-driven. People fled to their homes. Accident rates quadrupled. There are reports of suicides. Suicides? Do you know the last time there was one suicide in the Eternal City, to say nothing of multiples?
Thanos actually did know, and he opened his mouth to tell Cinta, but his friend cut him off with a gesture.
You have to recant. Say it was a really bad, practical joke, or say you've rechecked your math and you were wrong.
I will do no such thing. I will not lie.
Cinta shook his head.
Then at least rescind this euthanasia plan of yours. Tell people you'll come up with a better way.
There is no better way. I've expended considerable time and thought on this, and my plan is the only one guaranteed to work.
Then do something that's not damned guaranteed!
Cinta exploded, rising up, the cords of his neck rippling as he screamed.
You can't just say you're going to kill half the planet!
Thanos considered this.
But I did.
Cinta swallowed with difficulty, as though his throat had to choke down words.
I think you should leave, Thanos.
But
there's nothing else for me to say to you.
I thought we were friends.
Nodding slowly, Cinta pursed his lips. He looked down at his feet and took a great deal of time before he finally spoke.
Would you kill me if your algorithm dictated?
Thanos tilted his head to one side. It was an odd, almost childish question. He turned it over in his mind for a moment, in case he had missed some sort of subtle nuance. But there was none.
Of course, he told his friend. I'm going to kill myself too, Cinta.
Cinta nodded again, this time with his jaw clenched. He looked up at Thanos, his eyes glimmering and burning at the same time.
Go home, Thanos. There's nothing more to say.
On the way home, news spikes came through his personal receiver. 1,200 had died in the riots, and five times that number were injured in the wake of Thanos' broadcast. At home, he sat in darkness for a full 6 hours, thinking. He had lived with the knowledge of Titan's impending destruction for many days. He had steeped himself in the data. As a result, he was somewhat immune to its impact. He hadn't calculated the possibility that the mere knowledge of the catastrophe to come would have repercussions of its own.
1,200 dead.
Alars had appeared in Thanos' doorway, and was not bothering to conceal his abject fury. Thanos had never seen his father struggle so with emotion. Alars almost always was able to control himself, to keep his feelings bottled up, letting slip only the disgust and annoyance engendered by his son. Now, though, his full rage was on display, his complexion mottled, his face twisted into a rictus of ferocity.
1,200! You claim to love this world, Thanos, and you just killed 1,200 of your fellows. What do you have to say to that?
Thanos thought for a moment. He thought about the future generations that would never draw breath, of the children yet unconceived who would never be born, of the end of Titan. It was all too easy to imagine. He could see it in his mind's eye, hear the cries of the dying, the mourning of those left behind just long enough to feel regret.
1,200, he said. 1,200 souls. Statistically insignificant. Not nearly enough to have the ripple effect of my plan to save Titan. We'll still need to eliminate half the population.
Alars uttered a wordless cry.
I have larger concerns than a mere 1,200 lives,
Thanos said equably.
I am trying to save millions, and going forward, billions. I cannot be held responsible for what happened. I explained myself in simple terms. No one listening should have panicked. Listening!
Alars fumed.
Listening! You intruded on people's lives. You projected a... They saw a great monster bestride the city, promising to murder half of them. What result did you expect? I suppose I expected them to react with reason and compassion, not base animal instinct.
His father took a step back, the anger on his face rewritten into a sort of quiet horror.
We thought your mother was the Mad Titan, Alars said in a voice barely above a whisper. But I see now that this was false. You are Thanos. Your mind is as warped as your appearance. Your thoughts are as deviant as your flesh.
Thanos cleared his throat and stood, pulling himself to his full height. He clasped his hands behind his back and leaned in, towering over Alars.
And what, father, do you plan to do about it?
To his credit, Alars did not flinch when he answered. Chapter 9. Crime on Titan was nearly non-existent. There was no such thing as capital punishment, and no facility that could hold someone of Thanos' strength and intelligence. So the people of Titan decided on the most direct solution. Exile. Not exile from the Eternal City, no. Exile from the planet. And so, at the age at which Titans usually ventured out into their great society to discover themselves and their individual destinies, Thanos was cast not into the world, but rather from it. Space. The universe is not infinite. It merely pretends to be so. Chapter 10. The ship was named Exile One by those who'd put him in it. Thanos rechristened it Sanctuary. Chapter 11. He allowed himself a single look back on his homeworld as the ship breached the outer atmosphere and exploded into the star-pocked black of space. Titan's atmosphere, A thick, unyielding organonitrogen fog appeared orange from space. The Eternal City, swallowed by the haze, was invisible to the naked orbiting eye. Thanos told himself that everything he knew lurked beneath that haze. And then he told himself that it didn't matter. The ship's autopilot had been set to send him into the inner solar system, to worlds considered habitable places for one such as he. That was the safe course, the reliable choice. But he had no desire to be safe or reliable. They could banish him from Titan, but beyond that they could not claim his destiny. For the first time in his life, Thanos was free. Trapped in a tiny spaceship with few resources, yes, but free of second-guessing, free of hatred, free of fear and disgust, free of love, of the need for it. There was no one to love in Sanctuary except himself, and Thanos had better things to do with his time. The ship was tiny, essentially an oversized coffin grafted onto a sublight engine. Aimed into the inner orbits of the solar system, it had just enough speed and power to get him to one of the allegedly habitable worlds closer to the local star. He hacked the autopilot immediately. Every last atom in his being yearned to turn the ship around and head back to Titan, but that would only delay his exile, not end it. They would just fire him off into space again. If he headed inward, he would land somewhere within the solar system, somewhere primitive and raw, and lacking the technology needed to eventually return and save Titan. He would be stuck. But if he headed out of the solar system, away from the sun, there was an entire universe of possibilities. A panoply of worlds, a menagerie of races and species. Somewhere out there, he would find the help he needed. He would find a way to return to Titan and save his people despite themselves. Sanctuary was not designed for interstellar travel. Built to carry him a few light minutes away, it had limited fuel and only enough food and water for a month. He told the autopilot to plot a course to the Kree homeworld, Hala, the closest civilization he could identify. Proud, militaristic, the Kree possessed the technology and the know-how he needed. Titans were brilliant, but isolated. Conflict accelerated science, and the Kree had years of experience at war. They had armies and fleets of ships. Everything Titan lacked. He would return to Titan with an army at his back, if necessary. Whatever it took to convince his people to listen. When the time came, he would figure out how to persuade the Kree to help him. For now, it would suffice to get there. There was not enough power in the engines to make it to Hala, so he rerouted power from all other systems, including life support. The temperature in Sanctuary quickly dropped to below freezing. Thanos fought off the urge to shiver, and instead he closed his eyes and meditated himself into a trance state. Dimly, as though from a far-off distance, although it was from a speaker 10 centis from him, he heard the synthetic voice of the autopilot counting down to the maximum fuel burn he'd programmed. The course was plotted. The ship would do the rest. By the time the engines flared and Sanctuary lurched to life, blasting its way out of the solar system, Thanos had already meditated himself into a coma. He never saw the beauty of the stars blurring by as Sanctuary ferried him out of the solar system and into the galaxy beyond. And he dreamed. He dreamed her. She came to him. She touched him. She told him what to do.
"Remember when you wake," she told him. "Remember what I have told you."
"I will,"
he promised. But even in the dream, he knew that he would not. He knew that he would awaken and forget, that he would fail at so rudimentary a chore. And yet he promised anyway. In the dream, he imagined the memory was a physical thing, and he clung to it, holding it tight, swearing never to let it go. Chapter 12.
"He's a big one, he is."
A voice swam into the darkness and the silence.
Thanos tried to turn his head toward it, but couldn't move.
Truth, not lie,
said another voice.
Not lie, truth.
Aye, and sure,
said the first. Hands on him, at his neck. Something solid and heavy clicked into place there. Thanos struggled up, kicking against the tide of his self-induced coma. He tried to open his eyes, but they wouldn't cooperate.
Big and alive,
said the first voice.
Alive and big,
agreed the second. Thanos lost his fight against the dark. It swallowed him whole. When he at last opened his eyes, he thought first of his dream. He remembered her, remembered her whisper in his ear, her admonition to remember. And he recalled with perfect clarity his own certainty that he would not remember, that his memory would fail him. It had. He could not remember what she had told him. This all occurred to him in the instance between opening his eyes and his vision clearing from the blur of his long sleep. He lay on a bed, an old-fashioned affair that actually rested on a floor. Blankets, swaddled him rather than the comfort of a heat field. This was not the Kree homeworld, he realized immediately. The Kree possessed far better technology and comfort than this. Sitting up, a wave of nausea and vertigo overcame him, sending his head spinning and then crashing back down onto the pillow.
Remember,
she had told him.
Remember.
But he couldn't. He remembered setting the autopilot, inducing his own coma so he could survive on limited life support. He remembered the dream in exquisite detail, except for that one damned part. He clenched a fist. In his weakened state, it drained him, but felt good nonetheless.
He's awake, said a now familiar voice. Biggin's awake.
Awake and big now. Biggin awake.
And then a third voice.
So he is, on both counts.
Thanos lifted his head from the pillow again. This time, slowly. The world spun, blurred, then resolved itself. The chamber in which he found himself was dirty. The walls, made of metal, were pocked with patches of dull red rust. Light came from a single glowing orb overhead that occasionally pulsed dark just long enough to cause his eyes to adjust, then readjust to the return of brightness. A wheeled cart, one leg bent such that the whole thing appeared ready to kneel, stood off to one side, and by it stood a tall, slender biped with orange skin and pointed ears. His face was fleshy, the mouth wide and generous, and his eyes were round and yellow. He was bare-chested. He wore only a belted green kilt and boots, and a collar no doubt similar to the one Thanos had felt snapped around his own neck. He had an easy grin, which was both comforting and terrifying at the same time. Thanos wasn't accustomed to anyone being happy to see him. Standing by a door was another biped, this one with green pocked white skin, sunken cheeks, and a thatch of patchy brown hair. Thin to the point of emaciation, he wore rags for clothes along with a metal collar. On his shoulder perched a creature that resembled nothing so much as a gray blob of protoplasm merged with the top half of a hawk. Its wings and body melted into gray sludge on the man's shoulder, clinging there like stubborn snot.
I'm Cha Ragor, the orange one said in a pleasant voice. How do you feel?
Other than almost dying from asphyxiation, explosive decompression, starvation, hypothermia, and thirst, that is.
Thanos groaned as he sat up in bed.
You are a doctor?
Cha Ragor chuckled.
No, but I have some medical experience which qualifies me on this ship.
Ship?
He'd set Sanctuary to go into orbit and broadcast a distress call once it arrived at the Kree homeworld.
I'm on a ship? What ship? How did I get here?
You got lucky, Zal,
chimed in the bedraggled one. His pet immediately responded.
Truth, so truth, lucky, lucky.
Cha Ragor glanced back at them and shrugged.
They're not wrong. Your ship was on a collision course with ours. We almost disintegrated it, but his lordship didn't want to spare the blaster power, so instead we sent out an EVA crew to knock it off course. They picked up your life signs aboard and brought you in.
And where is my ship now? Cha looked back at the others.
Demla?
Demla's eyes lit up.
Probably about 12 light months that away,
he said, hooking a thumb over his shoulder.
12 that away, maybe 13.
The odd bird thing croaked. Thanos decided that his first act upon standing erect again would be to throttle the annoying bird thing. His second act would be to use this ship to arrive at his destination. It was owed to him, given that they'd left Sanctuary adrift in space.
How far am I into Kree space? How far from their homeworld?
Cha laughed.
Kree space? Is that where you thought you were going? You missed by quite a bit.
Thanos did not readily sulk, but he brooded quite well. He sat alone in the medical bay after Cha and Demla and the bird thing left, mulling over what he'd been told. He was hundreds of parsecs from the Kree homeworld, nearly starved and wearing around his neck the same tight gray collar he'd seen on Demla and Cha. It resembled images he'd seen of ancient shock collars. No doubt it was designed to harm or kill him if he attempted to remove it. He knew almost nothing about the ship on which he was recuperating, except its name, the Golden Birth. Judging by the medical bay, it was an aspirational name that had fallen well short of its goal. He'd missed Kree space entirely.
There's a new black hole out by the Arthrosian cluster,
Cha had explained.
Maybe it wasn't on your nav charts? Your autopilot wouldn't have compensated for the gravity well, so it dragged you off course.
Thanos had considered this for a moment, and then Cha had put a hand on his shoulder and said,
Sleep, my friend. All things move us forward, even our mistakes.
My friend, Cha had said. No doubt it was meant to be comforting, but the familiarity had only surprised and bemused Thanos. He was not used to being considered a friend so readily. Nevertheless, he took the advice and slept. He had lain near death for too long. His body was depleted. His mind buzzed and made concentration difficult. After a few days' rest, though, his body felt more robust, and his thoughts came more easily. Cha gave him permission to leave his sickbed, and Demla came to show him around the ship. The bird thing, it was named Bluco, and it was technically a shift blot, a semi-sentient creature occasionally found in Regellian territories, not a bird at all, went with them, of course, parroting Demla. Thanos didn't know which was more vexing, Bluco's echo or Demla's recursive, oblique speech pattern. One of them gave him a headache almost immediately. He was issued a large gray tunic to wear, along with a pair of boots. The tunic had been white once upon a time. Its original color still showed in a few patches at the seams. The boots' soles were worn through. He could feel the floor cold against his feet when he walked. The Golden Birth was a wheel ship, a curved tube rotating around a central axis, with 16 spokes that led into and out of the hub. From the look of the corridor Demla led him through, the medical bay was a good indicator of the condition of the ship as a whole. Curved reinforced pulso-glass portholes offered a view outside, but at least a third of them were patched over with a viscous paste to cover cracks that would otherwise suck out the ship's atmosphere into the vacuum. Thanos felt as though every step he took could be the one that rattled something crucial loose and killed everyone on board, including himself.
She spins something something number times a day,
Demla was saying.
Using central force.
Centripetal force,
Thanos corrected under his breath.
To mimic what you call gravity.
Gravity,
Bluco added.
Weighs us down.
Don't rightly understand it all,
Demla admitted.
But I ain't banging into the ceiling, so I guess it works.
Sure does,
Bluco burbled.
Who is his lordship?
Thanos asked.
Cha Ragor mentioned such a person. He owns the ship, I assume?
Demla shrugged.
You'll meet soon enough, suppose.
Meet his lordship, on your knees.
Bluco spat. Thanos ground his teeth together and essayed a pleasant smile.
Could we make it sooner than soon enough?
He had already been delayed too long from his plan to raise help on Hala. Formality and niceties were luxuries he couldn't afford. Demla shrugged again.
Make no harm, I guess.
On your knees!
Bluko repeated. They made their way through one of the spokes, passing many other aliens on their way. None of them made eye contact for more than a few moments, those with eyes at least, and most seemed not to bother evincing any sort of interest in Thanos. Even in the tight, cramped confines of the ship, where his size was, if anything, more a liability than in the Eternal City, Thanos felt comfortable. Here, in this motley crew of aliens, he finally blended in. Each of them wore a collar like the one around Thanos's neck. At the wheel ship's hub was his lordship's collection of chambers. Demla led him into a large, open room that served as a sort of throne room, apparently. It was dimly lit and in the same state of disrepair as the rest of the ship, which told Thanos that whatever his lordship might be, wealthy did not apply. His lordship sat, appropriately enough, upon a throne made of junk. Thanos recognized a chair leg jutting out from one side, a light-speed drive's inertial dampener burned out as part of the seat, and more broken pieces of debris welded together to form the ugliest, rustiest throne imaginable. The man was a study in contrasts, draped in a luxurious red velvet cloak that covered an old set of overalls and a dirty smock. He was tall and gaunt, with spare flesh hanging from his jaw and neck, as though he'd gone on an unexpected starvation diet. One eye was blue, the other brown. He was surrounded by a cluster of armed creatures, some of which were humanoid, a few with too many limbs or not enough.
"You, Neil,"
Demla muttered from his position on his own knees.
"Neil,"
Bluko chirped loudly. "The pet's right," said his lordship in a bored yet pleasant voice. "On your knees," he said, as though tired of the pageantry but resigned to it. Thanos sized up the situation quickly. He was stronger than anyone in the room, he knew, but there was the matter of their weapons, and of the collar around his neck. Still, it was best to test his lordship first, he reasoned. Thanos would never again have the element of surprise on his side. He could not overcome his lordship, but he could show that he would not quietly acquiesce.
"Be careful," he told himself. "Don't capitulate, but don't antagonize either." "I am unaccustomed to kneeling," he said neutrally.
His lordship's eyes widened. The blue one turned red, and the brown one shimmered a bright white for a moment.
"Oh, unaccustomed! I see. Well, that's understandable. Totally understandable."
He tilted his head at the being next to him.
"Robo, customize him."
A pasty white man with patches of graying facial hair and a monk's tonsure, Robo strode to Thanos, looked him up and down. Wearing a filthy robe with one pocket torn off, he was two heads shorter than Thanos and weighed possibly half as much. Just when Thanos was thinking how amusing was the idea of this little creature forcing him to kneel, a bright pain flared in the front of his skull, just behind his eyes. The world went a harsh and total white, dimmed, then flared again. He gasped, rocked back on his heels, grabbed his head in his hands. Everything in him fought against moaning aloud, but it happened anyway. He heard himself groan like a whipped child. The collar. Pain transmission along his vagus nerve. It was unlike anything he'd ever endured before.
"Strong cuss,"
his lordship commented. The pain shot through him again, and this time Thanos screamed unself-consciously and dropped to his knees.
"Better,"
his lordship declared.
"Now, was that so bad?"
As Robo stepped back, Thanos rubbed his temples, kneading away the pain. Tears dripped down his cheeks, wrenched from him.
"Ouch," said his lordship, pursing his lips. "Psychic spike. Hurts, I'm told. Feels sort of like an ice cream headache, dialed up to 100.
He stood from his makeshift throne and cleared his throat, a juicy, phlegmatic endeavor that concluded with him hawking and spitting a wad of gray sputum. A smallish, troll-like alien scuttled to his side and caught this spittle in his hands before it could hit the floor, then raced off through a door.
"Now then," his lordship said, standing over Thanos.
Are you becoming accustomed to kneeling? Is this working for you? Because it's a lot more convenient for me, let me tell you.
His eyes flashed different colors again, blue to green, brown to black, and then back. Thanos massaged away the last of the psychic's spike and gazed up at his lordship. From this vantage point, he had a delightful view up the man's nose, twin, craggy, hairy caverns glistening with greenish snot.
If my presence is inconvenient for you, Thanos said, I apologize. I could make your life easier by leaving.
His lordship's eyebrows shot up, and he clapped his hands with mirth.
Leaving! Did you hear that?
He turned in a circle, holding out his arms as though to gather in his entire entourage.
He wants to leave!
Giggles, chortles, peals of laughter from the crowd. Thanos clenched his jaw, sending ripples through his broad, ridged chin.
And where would you go?
His lordship asked.
We're deep in the Raven's sweep. Near a system is the Kaldeem Sorrow, and even that's parsecs away, and no life forms, nothing habitable. I guess I could just toss you out an airlock.
He frowned, looking down at Thanos.
Should I toss you out an airlock?
The answer was easy, but Thanos didn't know how his lordship would react. He might take a no as a challenge to his own authority and eject Thanos into space just to prove a point.
That would be a subpar course of events for me, he said, in as contrite a tone as he could muster through his frustration.
His lordship threw back his head and blasted out a series of guffaws that coaxed similar laughter from the others in the room. Thanos noticed that Demla, to his left, was laughing too, though the amusement didn't reach his eyes. Bluko had, somehow, gone to sleep.
Subpar!
His lordship howled.
Oh, I bet you. Say, what's your name, subpar course of events?
Thanos.
Thanos.
His lordship dragged it out, tasting the name on his tongue as it slipped through his lips.
And you must be from the planet of the purple people, eh?
No. Titan, Thanos pronounced.
Can't be. No purple people on Titan. Some lovely shades of Ekru, and a lass I knew once who was the most spectacular blue, azure even. No, more like cerulean, but no purple people.
I am an exception.
His lordship grunted noncommittally and shrugged.
Whatever. Let me explain how your life works now, Thanos of Titan. You are aboard the vessel the Golden Birth, and like all aboard this ship, you are my chattel person. Now, I know what you're thinking. Slavery is outlawed in most civilized regions of the galaxy, and you're right, it is. But this is not slavery. It's...
He paused, snapping his fingers.
Robo, what's that phrase? The one I keep forgetting?
Indentured servitude, my lord.
Yes?
His lordship tapped his fists together, and his blue eye went a bright orange for a few seconds.
Indentured servitude, that's it, thank you. And how much have we spent on Thanos here, Robbo?
8,274 yargblats, my lord. And 16 twillim, for retrieval, medical care, food.
The monetary units were nothing Thanos had ever encountered before.
8,000!
His lordship clutched his chest as though suffering a bout of angina.
So much money for so little reward! So much money, and all I get is lip!
He lashed out with his staff at that moment, catching Thanos on the right side of his face. His lordship was tall but scrawny. Thanos read the room and pretended that the blow rocked him to one side. Breathing hard from his exertion, his lordship drank in the hooting applause of those in the assemblage. Demla clapped weakly, an apologetic look on his face. Bluko stirred long enough to crow. Thanos resisted the urge to rise up and put his hands around his lordship's neck and squeeze until the man's head snapped off. Other than the synth he'd killed, he had, as far as he could remember, never once in his life raised a hand in violence. But his lordship was sorely testing that trend after only a few minutes. Although, there had been the one time. when he'd thought of striking his father.
Is this my fate, then? To turn from a creature of thought and reason into a creature of base instinct and violence?
We spent all this money on you,
his lordship was saying, now pacing and gesticulating wildly.
The exoship extraction, the medical attention, the clothes you're wearing, all of it, from me, due to my largesse and my kindness. All I ask in return is that you be polite and that you pay me back.
He punctuated those last words with repeated blows to Thanos' head and shoulders with the staff. They weren't terribly powerful, but Thanos feigned injury and collapsed to the floor. The collar. If not for the collar.
I apologize for my spiritedness, Thanos said through gritted teeth.
He had no desire to fawn over this absurd simpleton, but for now the best strategy was to play along. He looked at Robo, the one with the control for the collar.
If I could only...
His lordship held up a finger to call time out, then bent over, gasping and wheezing from his exertion. A thick stream of snot and phlegm lurched from between his lips and hung there, too heavy to retract but too viscous to break off.
A little help?
He called. That same troll-like creature scampered over with a soiled handkerchief and collected the snot, tugging it from his lordship's mouth. It took more effort than Thanos would have thought. His lordship wiped his mouth with the hem of his cloak.
Where was I? Oh, yes, pay me back. It's pretty basic. I'll do you a good turn, you repay me in kind. You will join the rest of the ship in my army, and when we get to where we're going, you'll kill a whole bunch of people for me, and then we're even. Got it?
He didn't wait for an answer.
Great! Glad we had this chat. Since you're feeling better, we'll get you out of the medical bay and doing something useful. Bye!
The audience was over. Chapter 13. He was assigned dank, cramped quarters with Cha Raegor. The room was so small that Thanos' head bumped the ceiling when he stood fully erect, and if he strained slightly, he could touch two opposing walls at both ends of the room at the same time. Cha eyed Thanos' bulk and sighed.
You can have the lower bunk.
The room carried a floral scent that Thanos could not identify, which made sense, given that he'd never left Titan before, and Cha had never been to Titan. Cha hailed from the Sirius system. There were a dozen worlds orbiting that star, and Cha called them all home. His people were peripatetic, roaming the universe in search of students for their distinct flavor of pacifistic philosophy. He was a skilled medic, doing his best to survive, and help as many as he could under conditions that could most charitably be described as deplorable. Thanos could not help comparing him to the only other true friend he'd ever had, Cinta. They could not have been more different. Cha was contemplative and quiet, where Cinta had been gregarious and boisterous. Cinta had a big, ready smile, while Cha tended more toward a pleased and subtle grin. And of course, Cinta had never left the Eternal City, while Cha had spent most of his life on the edge of the galaxy, preaching his philosophies to the barbaric unenlightened. Thanos could hear the calm sureness in Cha's voice whenever he spoke about his practices, the discipline and peace he wished on all those he met. He quickly learned that Cha meditated at every chance and would expound his philosophies at any opportunity.
You see, Thanos, Cha said calmly that first evening as they lay in their bunks. The universe itself can best be imagined as a garden. If we care for the garden, it grows and thrives. And even those areas that are not tended to do better, for they neighbor well-tended plots. The more peace we spread, the more the universe itself responds with peace.
Thanos thought of the word spread and gardens and manure. It seemed apt. And of course, the universe was nothing like a garden. The universe was, as best physics could tell, a recurring cyclical spasm of matter and energy that expanded and collapsed on a time scale unfathomable by mortal comprehension. There was no point trying to explain this to Cha.
There is a rhythm and a harmony to the universe.
Cha went on.
When they are in tune, life goes well for all beings, and there is peace. The reverse is also true, commutatively. When we bring peace, the universe itself is in harmony. The more peace we bring, the more the universe itself provides peace. Don't you just wonder at the splendor of the universe we've been given?
I wonder only if this particular sermon might end so I can sleep, Thanos grumbled,
then pulled his pillow over his head and tried to sink into the dark of sleep. It took a long time. He dreamed of her. She told him he could not remember. Chapter 14. He was assigned the most menial of tasks, scrubbing clean the reinforced pulsal glass that made up the Golden Berth's 4,112 portholes into the inky, empty blackness of outer space. He knew how many there were because he counted them as he cleaned them. By the time he got to the last one, the crew of motley aliens and castaways had already dirtied them again, and so he started over. Roaming round and round the ship's circumference. No beginning, no end. An ignominious fate for Thanos, son of Alars, son of Suisan, putative savior of Titan. A mind that once developed a perfect, painless, and fair method of killing was now put to the task of wiping windows clean of greenish alien slime that had hardened into a stubbly, pebbly shell. Sometimes he needed a chisel. The first two broke. The one benefit to his task was that it took him all over the ship. Along the way, he met many of his fellow indentured servants, who had never left their section of the ship. There was an entire family working the galley who were descended from the ship's original cooks and stewards. They'd never ventured farther than the general mess hall. My grandfather once brought a meal to his lordship in his personal quarters. One of the cooks confided in Thanos. Came back unable to speak. Later we realized that was because his lordship had removed his tongue. The entire ship was a sealed system, both literally in the sense that it was spaceworthy, and figuratively in the sense that pretty much nothing and no one entered or left. They had their own society here, their own currency, their own culture, a hodgepodge of 10,000 different eras and worlds. Thanos took advantage of his meanderings around the ship. So long as he did his job, no one bothered him. In fact, some of his fellow servants even seemed happy to see him. In short order, he was surprised to find that he felt more welcome and at home on the Golden Berth than he had in his entire life on Titan. In spite of himself, Thanos found himself adapting to the rhythms and tides of life aboard the Golden Berth. He began to feel comfortable there, accepted by its low-class buffoons in a way the elites of Titan had never even considered. Much to his surprise, he began to relax, and even his attitude began to take on their loose and decompressed means. If not for the danger still looming over Titan and the oppressive presence of his lordship, he might have even begun to enjoy his time on board. Still, as welcomed as he felt, this motley collection of ragged servants and slightly less ragged sycophants could never measure up to the memory of Titan and its people. He knew that he needed to get off the ship, and then find a way to the Kree Empire, where he could marshal forces to save Titan. It was imperative that he rescue his people from their own blindness and ego, that he force them to see the error of their ways and listen to him. He needed a plan. He needed a way out. The first order of business in any plan would have to be removing the shock collar he wore. He tried brute strength to start, gripping the collar tightly and applying all his muscle to it. It had clicked around his throat in two pieces, but nothing he did separated them even a millimeter. Next, he purloined a medical laser when Cha was distracted in the medical bay. But the laser, designed to cut flesh and bone, had no impact on the metal collar, not even when he modified it to run off a stronger power source. He was unaccustomed to failure,
He'd never really had to plan beyond his initial impulses, letting his intellect guide the way to success.